Hi, folks. This is Jack Spierko with another edition of the Survival Podcast. As always, one man's view of the changing world, the changing times, and the things we can all do to live a better life if times get tough or even if they don't. Today is August the 15th, 2016. It's a Monday. That means it's a show that you guys basically write the script for with your emails to me. You send those emails to jack@thesurvivalpodcast.com with TSPC in the subject line and then anything else you want. But that TSPC will call that email to my attention as being a show email. Again, the email you send that to is jack@thesurvivalpodcast.com. Ask me your question or make your point in one or two sentences, then give me your details. Use the return key a couple times before you do that. Put a little space in between your writing. Don't send me giant blobs of text. I don't like that, and I tend not to read it even if it's good stuff. But you guys that are doing your businesses online and stuff and blog posts and all, you know all the rules about when a new paragraph starts and all. On some sites, yeah, but on blogs and comments, if you actually want your stuff read, once there's a block that's any significant size, find an excuse to hit the return key. I'm just saying, not just with emails to me, but online reading, it just works better that way. There's nothing like a giant mob of blocked text that's like 80 sentences long to make a person go, can't do it, just can't read it. Just saying. Little tip from Jack today. Anyway, I do have a great deal of stuff for you guys today. A lot of variety. Really liked some of the questions that came in this last week. We have a guy that wants to trade his AR in for a lever gun. He actually has his reasons, and they're pretty sound, and I'll give some thoughts about what to look for in a lever gun. We have a guy with a sad, funny truth about type 1 errors. I'm sure he meant it as a off-the-hand joke with some sadness and some humor, but it actually makes a poignant point that follows up what Jeff Lawton said about type 1 errors last week. You know, first Bitcoin was mocked. Now it will be emulated, it seems like, that the world financial institutions are all looking at developing their own versions of blockchain technology. Thoughts on non-metallic knives like carbon fiber knives for places you can't take something metal and what it can and can't do for you. Safety considerations of DEET-based insect repellent. I have a father that's concerned about using this on his children's skin, but he's also concerned about things like Lyme disease and West Nile and, you know, Zika, which I don't know that we need to worry about Zika where he's at, but it is a concern. And Patrick Rohrman has a little video for us he's put out on one-handed neck knife sheath use, how to deploy and return your knife to your sheath safely while using only one hand with your neck knife. And I have a question about using the interactive ed with government schools and how to manage it for those that cannot homeschool their kids. And we'll clean up with something new coming to the world, open source textbooks. Yes, open source textbooks. We all know that, especially in college, that textbooks are an extreme expense. And I think this is just one more sign of the coming end of the modern educational paradigm. Before we get into all that, though, let's go ahead and take a look at the year that was the episode. Alex Shrug has several for us today at tspwiki.com. We have a man in uniform and a woman in pants. We have the view of Yosemite. And we have the memory of the 13 martyrs. We also have, in other news, Patrick Kennedy escapes the Great Famine in Ireland and lands in Boston. He is the great-great-grandfather of President John F. Kennedy and Senators Robert and Ted Kennedy. Edgar Allan Poe dies in Baltimore at the age of 40. Quoth the Raven, nevermore. Newspapers report he died of alcoholism, but the truth is no one really knows. And Elizabeth Blackwell becomes the first woman physician in the United States. She is granted entrance to medical school at Holbert College through the unanimous vote of 150 male students then enrolled. Yeah, women's rights have come a long way, folks. You had to get all the male students to say it was okay to have a woman in medical school. The students got to decide that? Yeah. And I guess maybe one could have ruined it? I don't know if that's how that worked out or not. I will note Edgar Allan Poe dying at 40 this year is one of my favorite authors of all time. I didn't have a lot of great teachers in high school, but I had one that was pretty good named Mr. Machowski, and I had him for an advanced literature course. And we dissected quite a bit of Poe's work, including The Raven and The Cask of Amontillado, and it made me a lover of Poe's work. And Poe is one of those guys you wonder what he might have done with another 40 years. What other things may have come out of his mind. And you also wonder, with some of the darkness of his writing, if maybe that's part of why he only made it to 40. No one really knows, as Alex says. The one I'm going to read for you, though, is The Memory of the 13 Martyrs, because I have kind of an interesting take on Alex's take. The Hungarians recently rebelled against their Austrian masters, and war has been hard and bloody. The rebels seem to be winning until the Russians stepped in. Now it looks hopeless, mostly because it is. A last-ditch effort, the Hungarian rebels turned to General Artur Gregory. If anyone can do it, he can, but he can't do it. He surrenders. The Austrians want to hang him, and so do a few Hungarians, but the Russians spare his life. Instead, the Austrians hang 12 other generals and one colonel. Many others will be put to death, but these men will be remembered as martyrs to the cause well into the modern day. My take by Alex Shrugged. You cannot keep a memory like that alive unless you have a regular reminder of the loss. That usually involves some sort of custom or regular ritual. It is rumored that the Austrians had been raising their beer glasses and clicking them in celebration of the deaths of these men. That is why the Hungarians stopped clinking their glasses when drinking beer. However, the custom started falling away in 1999 with the millennials and is maintained only by the older generation of patriots now. So here's my take on this. Things can be handed down generation to generation for the positive or the negative, and ritual or story or emotion can all be used to maintain them and to take them through history for good or for bad. A good example would be the stories of our founders and the Declaration of Independence. If you look at the Declaration of Independence, you know, much more so than the Constitution, it's almost a document of pure anarchy. It is a document about the sovereign rights of individuals over anything else, and people having a right to choose their own destiny. And the level that you have of a people that respect that, the greater its preservation will be in modern times. And as you've seen over the generations, less and less admiration for the one of our founding documents. However, another thing that's been handed down generation to generation, and you like to see it at, you know, go into entropy and to go into decline and to begin to go away, is something like racism, institutionalized racism. There were a lot of things used to keep racism as something that people would accept over the years, especially in our nation in particular. And one wonders why we can't have the good preserved and the bad die off. Why does it seem that all ideas over time enter entropy and begin to collapse and begin to be forgotten? And is it that we need more rituals, traditions, and customs that reinforce to our young generations the good of our past and a greater desire to separate us from the evils of our past and to indeed be able to see the two of them separately rather than lump them all together? And I think that's the problem. If you look today, every time you see somebody point out something bad about Donald Trump, the response is, but Hillary sucks worse. And whenever anybody points out something bad about Hillary Clinton, Trump sucks worse. Now, I know that doesn't seem like those two go together, but it does, because that's our society. Whatever you don't like, you lump it in with all other things that are clearly evil, and therefore everything about it must be bad, and there can be no good there. The more things change, the more they stay the same, or in this case, maybe sometimes the more they change. My take by Jack Spearco. With that, let's get into your first question for me today. This is a gun question. Guys, I love the gun questions, man. Keep them coming. It says, hey, Jack, I'm thinking about selling my AR and getting a pistol caliber lever gun. Any thoughts about that? Any thoughts about 357 versus 44? Some details. Due to recent laws in Ohio, I could use the lever gun for deer now. I don't really have a practical purpose for the AR. For home defense, I have my pistol, and a lever gun would serve well for that, too. I'm not an operator who operates operationally, and since I have gotten married and started the seeds of a homestead, I don't have any interest in being a door kicker with the team for 299 days when the zombies come. Any opinions would be great. Thanks for the show, Russ. I think some people will be thinking, Jack's going to tell Russ, dude, just save up for a new lever gun and keep the AR. On some levels, you might want to, just from an investment standpoint. I think that there is potential in the future for another assault weapons ban, and it may be the case that you know, it's kind of a, it's a moratorium on the new, on sale of new guns. Cause I don't know, I don't think their government believes right now in any way that they can take all the guns away without bloodshed. I think they're aware of that. In fact, let me speak up for somebody I don't speak up for very often and probably won't speak up very often, for Donald Trump real here as an aside on this one. So Donald Trump recently got in hot water again with the press because he was making a comment about Hillary Clinton and her putting judges on the Supreme Court. And if she gets her way, she'll put anti-gun judges on there. And you can kiss your guns goodbye, folks. You can kiss them all goodbye. There's nothing you can do except maybe, you know, the Second Amendment people. And he goes on. And, of course, the media went, oh, my God, you know what he said? He said that they should do something horrible to Hillary Clinton. He's sanctioning violence against Hillary Clinton. You know what? The press and both sides of the dichotomy have turned into like a bunch of little stupid schoolgirls, right? Like little fourth graders or something. Ooh, did you hear what he said? And then just changing it to fit the ooh narrative. Ugh. Okay, let me tell you something about Donald Trump's comment about the Second Amendment. He's dead on, and it does involve violence. But it's not directed violence at Hillary Clinton or any other specific person. I think what Trump said in a moment of honesty is, if they take the guns from these people are not going to let it happen. They will use the Second Amendment for its intended purposes, which is to defend the rights of the people. And I just hope that anybody out there that's an advocate for, gamey, take all the guns away, we need more gun control, you understand what you're asking for. You push it far enough and what you're asking for is war. Just understand that. If you're okay with that, fine. But that's what you're asking for, because there are millions of us that we do have a line in the sand. And for many of us, we're not sure where that line exactly is yet. When would we say, that I can't do it anymore. Now it's time for the Second Amendment to be revealed in all of its intention. But most of us know there is a point. There is a point. There is a point where you can go too far. And we'll just say, no, you're not going to do this anymore. And that is the intent of the Second Amendment. And there's nothing wrong with what Donald Trump said about the Second Amendment on that particular day. There's plenty of things that Donald Trump says wrong. And I'm sure there'll be a whole ass load more, but that wasn't one of them. Anyway, on this question itself, I can see getting rid of your AR. And I'm just going to say that if that's what you want to do, go ahead and do it. I've said my piece about maybe the monetary thing or the collectibles thing or the gun ban thing. Ohio will let you use a rifle now to hunt deer, so I'm guessing that either the whole state, because I don't know Ohio's game laws, or your area was a shotgun-only area for deer, which was always dumb. A lot of these places where they say it's necessary, it's just not necessary. But fine, they've seen the error of their stupidity. Probably from, you know, 20 years of people running around with rifled sabots, shotgun slugs, and the world not ending. But I guess the question then would be, would a lever gun be the best option for a deer rifle? And would a lever gun in .357 or .44 Magnum be the best option? Now, I don't know. Maybe in this, you know, now that they're letting cartridges be used instead of shotguns, maybe there is a caliber limit. So I would tell you, if that's not the case and you want a lever gun, take a really good look at like the Marlin 336 and 336C in either 3030 Remington or 3030 Winchester or 35 Remington. That both of those rounds are, in essence, probably a better deer round than the 357 or the 44. So I'm just saying, if it's just for deer and it's still a fine home defense round, trust me, I do not want to get hit in the noggin with a 200 grain round nose out of a 35 Remington at home defense ranges. That would be a bad freaking day, right? So it would serve the purposes equally well. The 1894, 1895 Marlins and the 336 are not that different in weight, length, etc. So it's not like the gun is, you know, that much better handling for the wood tonner or something like that. So you might want to consider that. If you're going to go the route of pistol, because that's what you want, and I'm trust me, I love pistol caliber carbines. I still have this aching in my neck to go out and buy the Ruger 7744, which is a bolt action, or 77357, which is a bolt action 357 Magnum. So I get it. Overall, as a deer round, the 44 Magnum is superior than the to the 357 Magnum. It will do a better job of putting large-bodied whitetails down. In Ohio, you have some pretty big deer. You have deer that are a lot like the deer I grew up hunting in Pennsylvania. It is not uncommon for bucks to go 220 to 240 pounds. I personally believe it has a lot to do with the states that have a lot of snow in them. The deer having to move through the snow over time, natural selection, you know, builds up larger-bodied deer that can move through all that deep snow. And so I would say of the two, from a pure standpoint of which is a better deer round, 44 Magnum, hands down. However, out to 100 yards, and I would say even to 125 yards, the 357 Magnum is an adequate round for deer, especially with a properly constructed bullet. It has some inherent advantages over the 44. It is quieter. It is quieter both its Magnum and 38 Special compared to the 44 Magnum and 44 Special loads. It is very inexpensive to hand load. The ammo overall is less expensive than the 44 Magnum. And it is both are actually very easy to hand load, but the 357 Magnum is easy and cheap to hand load for. I believe Lee even makes a small Lee loaders where you basically load using a plastic mallet, in 357. I think you can get one of those little pocket reloaders for it. So it's got some advantages there. When we start looking at downloading it for practice or for other applications, both can be downloaded effectively, and I am a huge fan of downloading the 44 Magnum. I have an 1895 in 44 Magnum and I love it. And I make a round out of it I call the world's largest pellet gun, which is the very lightest published load I could find using 300 grain cast lead loads for 44 Special, and you can hear the hammer fall. That's how quiet it is. But in my accuracy testing, in retained accuracy, I found that 38 light 38 Special loads tend to hold their accuracy to a greater distance than light 44 Magnum loads do, and I guess there's something to do with the ratio of the calibers there, but they just seem to kind of hold a little bit more of like that, you know, small game size group on a download. So I don't think you could go wrong either way. Neither one of them recoil at all, right, in a rifle. They just don't. There's no real recoil to either one. For both of them, I recommend you stay away from hollow points. Most of the hollow point ammo, or I should say bullets, that are designed for both of those cartridges obviously have been designed around the concept of pistol velocities. And it's not a little leap in velocity, it is a big leap in velocity between the pistol and the rifle length barrels. I've done it so many times I won't do it again, but we're not talking a couple hundred feet per second. We're talking 400, 500, 600 feet per second in some instances of additional muzzle velocity, and in some cases more, depending on the load. The rounds that I would recommend for this, the bullets, if you were hand loading, is the Hortney 158 grain XTP flat tip in 357. And I think it's an XTP as well, but Hornady also makes a 44 caliber 265 grain bullet that was specifically designed for the 444 Marlin. And it is a dadgum sledgehammer out of the 44. And it's a flat point designed for heavier, higher velocities. And it is a really, really good round. Otherwise, if you're buying factory ammo, any good flat point, 240 grain in the 44, 158 grain in your 357, I think would be the way to go. Jacketed, solid, you know, good bullet construction for big game use. And, for home defense, you know, I think you go back to hollow points. I don't think that a lever action rifle is a particularly great home defense gun though. A handgun, I think, actually is one of the best home defense tools you could have. But when it comes to, if you are going to go to like a carbine style thing, I think you are better off with a semi-auto like the AR. Or something, you know, in between, like a Kel-Tec Sub 2K and either 9mm or 40 Smith & Wesson. Those are actually outstanding little home defense guns. They really are. They give you some real advantages over just a handgun. But I have no problem with your decision. Kind of those are my recommendations around it. Let's go to the next one. This is one that I said that's kind of a funny, sad thing, almost like a one-liner from a comedian, and I think that's how it was intended. And it's from Patrick, and not the Patrick that makes the knives, though. I don't give away last names unless I'm told to on the air, but just there's no Patrick that I think anybody in this audience probably knows other than, you know, if you guys do have some friends that are TSP listeners together, maybe you do know who Patrick is, but no Patrick of note. He says, "My marriage was a type 1 error." And it is a little bit funny, and then it's sad after it's funny, right? But I can almost hear, you know, remember Rodney Dangerfield? I get no respect. My marriage, it was a type 1 error, right? I mean, you can almost hear Rodney saying something like that. And I think he's referring to my definition of a type 1 error, which is also Bill Mollison's, which is a type 1 error is an error that you begin to regret as soon as you commit it, and you continue to regret it forever, right? For like the rest of your life. You just think, I shouldn't have done that. But remember what Jeff's definition of a type 1 error was. Jeff Lawton said last week, a type 1 error is a good idea executed poorly. And I say, no, both of them fit together. Putting a dam in the wrong location is a type 1 error because it fits my definition. You regret it for the rest of your life after you do it, and it's very difficult to change. However, a dam is a good idea. It's now been poorly executed, so it fits Jeff's definition as well. I think we can have that with marriage. I think marriage is a perfectly wonderful idea, and I say that as a man who will be in October, have been with his wife for 20 years, though we weren't married for 20 years. That's how long we've been together, and we just celebrated, I think, our 12th or 13th anniversary as a married couple. And I think marriage is a fine idea. But, you know, there are marriages that are done improperly and poorly and fundamentally flawed from the beginning. And I think calling them type 1 errors makes perfect sense. But I wonder, in our institution of marriage, do we have a lot of other type 1 errors? Like the concept of the family court system ensures that a divorce does as much damage to a family as possible. I mean, I think the family court system is a good idea, poorly executed. It does make sense that there might be some sort of mediation when emotions are high and I'm mad at you and you're mad at me and we have a couple kids together and somebody has to see their well-being. The concept of a mediation is a good idea. The way that it's done actually ensures that the anger is inflamed on both sides and that as much misery is enacted on the family and as much capital as possible is extracted from the family as possible. I think government being involved in marriage is a terrible idea. So I think government fooling around with the institution of marriage in itself is a type 1 error. And I wonder how many places we could look at and go, that's a really good idea, but the type 1 error is the involvement of a third party with guns and power that doesn't need to be involved. I mean, I want you to think about it this way. If you were living in a permaculturist utopia, you were living in like this place where there was food and water and everything you ever needed, and then you met somebody and you kind of like were living like Survivor except the good life, right? And you met somebody and you thought, man, this is a perfect husband/wife, whatever. And you guys get married, you move into your little hut in Tahiti or whatever, and you're having your life and you're having your kids and you're raising your family and everything's just kind of trucking along. Would you ever just stop and say, you know what, honey, this stuff we have is so wonderful, we've just got to get the government involved in this? I don't think you would. So we have to ask ourselves, how many type 1 errors are there out there that are simply because government got involved with an otherwise good idea? Just my thoughts on that one. Moving on, I have an email here from Andy. And Andy sends me this article, says, the New York Times article on blockchain being recognized by the World Economic Forum. Quote, the report estimates that 80% of banks around the world could start to distribute distributed ledger projects by next year. Large central banks are also studying how the blockchain will alter the way money moves around the globe. And there's a link to the article. I'm not going to read it. That quote is enough for discussion purposes about what's going on here. Well, there's a couple things. One, it's on the surface, it is what it looks like, and that is that when Bitcoin came out, all the government agencies, all the central banks, all of the big commercial banks all said, this is an awful idea. You can't trust it. Don't put your money there. It's going to be used by drug dealers, like their money isn't or something, you know. It's going to be used by terrorists. Ah, the world's going to end. And it's not going to succeed anyway because it's a dumb, stupid idea and only dummies would get involved with it. And it's for nothing but dummies and criminals. And now they're all like, about what we said. Just forget all that. This stuff works really good, and we want a piece of it. So what you have are most of the banks around the world now trying to come up with their own versions or representations thereof of not Bitcoin but blockchain technology, which is the means by which Bitcoin or other alternative currencies are actually moved. They like this idea, except there's one thing really holding them back. It doesn't make them money like the existing system does. So they're trying to figure out, how do we do this and maintain our ability to profit from it? Or how do we do this and come up with another roundabout way of profiting from it? And the governments, I think, are snapping to this because I think government looks at this and goes, this Bitcoin thing sucks. We don't like it. But if our money worked like that, and instead of letting people make it as private or as public as they wanted it to be, if we made it completely disclosable to, like, the IRS or, you know, insert your country's version of the vulture that oversees your taxes, it would be great. Nobody could spend a dime without us knowing where it came from, where it went. So I think government's very interested in going to a cashless society with a technology like this. They always have been. I think the problem they had with Bitcoin when it came out is, well, it was the right way to do it, but since the private sector went first, if we do it now, then people have a place to go to outside of our system that they've never had before. And that's why they hated it, and that's why they tried to kill it. And that tells you how good it is. You know how good Bitcoin is because every major bank and every major government in the world attempted to vilify it and kill it, and it succeeded anyway. And now they're attempting to emulate it because it defies their reasoning that their attempts to kill it didn't work. And I'll tell you where I think this kind of fits in with another thing that government is really considering around the world, including right here at home. And I'm neither for nor against this because I'm against everything that the government wants to do. So I'm just analyzing it before anybody gets their panties in a wad one way or the other about it. But UBI, or Universal Basic Income, there's an article I saw today circulating on Facebook where they're proposing a $13,000 a year universal basic income for every single citizen of the United States. And that once you go over a certain amount of money, it drops to $6,500, which I think is bullshit, by the way. If you're going to do this, then everybody should get their UBI the same. And you shouldn't punish the producers. They're going to be paying the freaking bill in the first place. But, you know, whatever on that. But the concept was it replaces everything. So before you get all wadded up about Marxism and socialism, what they're saying about UBI would be, okay, every citizen 21 years of age and up gets $13,000 a year for their whole life. Okay, now that, forget the number, because it's one ass clown on Wall Street Journal or something like that floating the idea. Right, so he picked his number. And in his plan, which nobody gives a shit about because he's not even a congressman and no one would care if he was because it takes more than one congressman to do something. So just don't get stuck on the particulars. But under his plan, $3,000 of it would have to be used toward health insurance premiums, and you get rid of Social Security. You get rid of Medicare. You get rid of Medicaid. You get rid of food stamps. You get rid of every single social program that we have. You get rid of all the bureaucrats that run them. You send them home to find real jobs, and then everybody gets their $13,000 a year deposited electronically into their accounts. The guy makes a pretty good case in the article that the numbers work, but that's because he's bullshitting, and the numbers do not work. I've run the numbers. These numbers do not work. This program would take more money than there is in our annual budget if you got rid of everything, including like the whole Department of Defense. But how could you make something like this work? What if you used a blockchain-style currency with known rules and what have you, and you could adjust UBI how much. It's just, how can you say, well, people get $13,000 for the rest of their life? That's not a lot of money right now. But how much money do you think it would be in 25, 30 years? Right? What would it do? So you know any kind of government program like that would have to have raises built into it. But what if you could create a purposely built deflationary currency that became stronger over time, so a fixed program like a UBI would become something that would be sustainable in basic level existence, right? You can't live on $10,000 a year, but you kind of can because people do, right? So, and you can live on 20, not great, but you can. So if everybody had 10, you'd only have to make another 10 to kind of get to that basic threshold. And I'm not saying it's a good idea. I'm just saying this is what governments are thinking right now. They see the coming wave in automation, and they know what's coming. That's why all this stupid shit started. You know, the whole striking fast food workers that walked out on their jobs. And again, not one person, not one, I'm so sick of it, not one of you people that have told me I'm wrong about this can show me one place that one person ever went ever and couldn't get their Big Mac because the fast food workers were on strike. Because there was no strike. The whole thing was pantomime. The whole thing's theatrics. This fight for 15, it's all bullshit. It's all fake. It's all phony. Because then they show the converse is, meet your replacement. Here's the kiosk. The kiosk was coming anyway. And if a redneck duck farmer like me in Texas knows this, the people that are pulling the strings, not the politicians, the people that they're puppets with strings drilled into their asses and their mouths, and the people moving them around and making them dance like a bunch of dumb jackasses for you, they know this too. And they're trying to figure out, how do we prevent a French Revolution? How do we prevent all these people from going god-awful crazy and starting to drag the people, whoever they blame, into the streets and roll the guillotine back out and start lopping off heads? How do we placate the masses? We created this mess. Sooner or later, they're going to look to us and go, hey, what the hell? And I think UBI is one of their outs. You cannot do it with the current economic system. And the current economic system has a built-in tidal wave avalanche of death and destruction in it called what? I've been talking to you about this for over 8 years. Unfunded liabilities to the tune of $150 trillion of unfunded liabilities. So what if your government, in one fell swoop, could placate the masses by giving everybody $10,000 or $20,000 a year even? Flipping the economic system to a blockchain technology with known rules, but at the same time, wipe out $150 trillion of unfunded liabilities. Never pay the bill because the programs that say the bill have to be paid all go away. In the end, that program would cost less. Again, I'm not saying it's a good idea. I'm not saying it's a bad idea. I'm saying whatever they did would never be what somebody's floating as a plan now anyway, so getting stuck on the particulars is not worth it. But I think the macro level, when we look really big, the governments of the world know the current economic system is failing. They know the current economy is shifting. They know the system has to change. And they know the debts that they've run up can never be paid. So they have to come up with a creative way that would make everybody feel good about what in the end would be a default on those debts. And it would, the only reason it would not be called a default is the debts would cease to exist. There would be nobody looking to get paid because you're starting getting paid right now. Now, here's the problem. There's a whole lot of people in retirement right now that are already getting more than that on Social Security. They would have to develop a wean-off period for the people that are on Social Security and maybe in some other social services. So it's not as clean as they make it out. So that's what I said. The money he said is there and makes a compelling case that it is there isn't really there. Because you can't tell the 82-year-old lady that's getting $1,600 on Social Security, well, your Social Security is going down to $900, $800 a month, and you don't have to worry about it, though, because you get that for the rest of your life. She's barely making on $1,600. She can't go back. She can't make up the difference now. What about the person that's, 64? and is just about to retire in the next 5 years, 2 years, 1 year, whatever it is, you can't tell them, oh yeah, we're just changing what you're going to get. Who can you tell it to? Millennials. See, you can offer people that are retired the ability to keep it. The people that are almost retired to get most of it. The people like me and my wife and Jack's generation, us Xers and tweeners, you can offer us like, you know, a little bit of it. Like, okay, you'll get your 10 grand, 13 grand or whatever it is. Plus you'll get X, Y, and Z piece of it. And then you guys are all like 35 and under. You paid some Social Security, but hey, look at all this money you're going to get right now. You're getting a $10,000 a year raise. Right now, you don't have to pay tax on it. It's all free. And you get it for the rest of your life. But you don't get Social Security. Woo! Done. Millennials don't think they're getting it anyway. In fact, they know they're not. My generation, we're like, maybe, probably, I don't know. Right? So as you go from my generation down, screwing with Social Security, not for the people already there, but for us. And you're going to tell me, oh, not only do I get your 10, 20,000, whatever it is, of space euro credits or whatever the hell they are, you don't have to pay SSI anymore. So for me, self-employed, that's almost 15% tax cut. I don't like the plan, but compared to what we have, where I get myself raped every year in tax dollars, and I get nothing out of it because they're doing shit I don't want to do, I'd switch the two systems. Doesn't mean I want either one of them, but I'd switch the two systems. I'm just saying. And if I would, how hard do you think it's really going to be to sell this to the American people, especially with a new monetary system? Not as hard as you would think. I know it'll never happen. It might not. I'm just telling you the way they're thinking right now, and this all points to it. Let's take another one. So the next one is a question about non-metallic knives. This is from Marty. Marty says, I just listened to your episode on knives. While listening, it reminded me of a question I have about non-metallic knives. Question, what restrictions on knife carry, with restrictions on knife carry in many locations, such as sporting venues, what do you think about carbon fiber? If I can't conceal carry and can't even carry a knife, what are my best options? Details. I have a few cold steel Delta darts I have used in the past for non-metallic protection, but I have no experience with carbon fiber and thought you might be able to shed some light on the subject. Here's just one example of one knife I looked into, and it's a carbon fiber EDC knife, kind of about the size of like a Patrick Roman neck knife. I'm looking forward to your response, Marty. Okay, carbon fiber is exactly what it says, carbon fiber. And all a carbon fiber knife is a, you know, they use a tool or a machine to shape it like a knife and put an edge on it and make it sharp. They're sharp. They are very sharp. I have watched quite a few YouTube demos leading up to today's podcast on people demonstrating them and doing cutting tests with them on things like a big old hunk of meat, including meat wrapped with like a, you know, a pant leg from jeans. And they put a deep, significant cut when used in a slashing motion. However, about three cuts and they're done. The edge is gone. The video I watched that's most prominent, they did three cuts into like a big roast, two into just the meat and one through the jeans, and they didn't think it would work and it went right through the jeans on the first cut. And on the fourth attempted cut, when they went back to the jeans with it, actually they did a meat cut, a jean cut, a meat cut, and they went back to the jeans, it wouldn't do jack crap. It would have, if you would have sliced somebody wearing, you know, a jean coat or something like that, it wouldn't even have went through the coat. It would have been completely useless. That said, use it a quick, you know, serious lethal strike, something like to the throat, or across an arm to create a, like you're using it for self-defense, somebody grabs you, and instead of getting into a struggle with them, if you pull that out and drug it across their arm and open their arm up, they're going to let go, right? So the question, though, then becomes, like, when does edged weapon defense become reasonable? So somebody grabs you, is it reasonable to hack their arm with a knife? I think it depends on the situation. I don't know. Well, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to put all of the legalities and things aside and say, if one wanted to carry a knife that could be used as a lethal weapon for whatever reason, and assuming just that it would be legally used. It would be used when legally considered necessary for defense and in true life and death situation, and wanted it to be non-metallic. The only real option I know of is ancient technology. It would be an obsidian blade. An obsidian blade can be honed to a razor sharp edge. They are extremely lethal. They have a long history of being used in warfare in ancient history, and even not that long ago, honestly. In some places in the world, obsidian is still used by hunter-gatherer societies. Obsidian is basically natural glass. The other thing I kind of knocked around in my brain a little bit was, well, what about a ceramic knife? Because ceramic knives are very sharp. My initial concern was, well, they are sharp, but they're also fragile. If you have to do a stabbing move with a ceramic knife and you get bone, you're a lot more likely to have one crack. But, you know, that can happen with any knife. So, the functionality of a ceramic blade would make it a significant lethal tool if necessary. However, it's always there. Most ceramic knives, as far as I know, have quite a bit of metal blended in the ceramic, and they would be, you know, they would go off on a metal detector. So I think there's another thing to consider here. Most venues that are, you know, running you through a metal detector to see if you're carrying a knife, I think if you were carrying a non-metallic knife to defeat the metal detector, I think technically you might be breaking a law, or at least a rule, and you might get thrown out, banned from the facility. I don't know. So you have to check the local laws and understand your own risk in all of these situations. But I think carbon fiber knives are like, they're kind of like a disposable razor that you get one half of a shave out of, right? It's not that they don't work at all. It's not that they suck, but they only do so much good. Now, products like the Delta Dart from Cold Steel, and Cold Steel makes a variety. They make a plastic karambit, a hard reinforced ABS plastic karambit that has a sharp point. That's a reasonable defensive tool. It's not going to do a lot of cutting, but the karambit tool that they have like that, very lightweight, it certainly would pass through a metal detector. It's not just that it has the good stabbing feature. As a karambit, it is a reasonable tool for holding control and understanding how to use that tool as a less than lethal tool. I also want to point out that tool could be lethal. A strike to the throat with that tool could certainly be lethal. You might look more at those types of things for now. I think the day that somebody produces something akin to a carbon fiber knife that can hold its edge for more than two or three uses, is probably not that far away. But the stuff I've looked at this point, I wouldn't bet my life on it. I would rather rely on something that I could effectively carry as an impact weapon. So a non-metallic impact weapon might be something more useful for those situations. A sap cap might be an interesting thing. So you basically have a baseball-style cap that has a beanbag sewn into the top of it that's full with something like the shot that they use for sandblasting. So it's non-metallic, and I mean, you think it's a joke until you grab the bill of one and smack something with it. It's a pretty effective impact tool. That may be a better break up the conflict type thing. I mean, if you're thinking like active shooter situations and stuff like that, your knife, plastic or otherwise, isn't going to be very useful anyway. So when you go to sporting events and things like that, what you're more worried about is the person that's going to try to mug you, grab you, maybe try to stab you because they don't follow the rules or whatever. So what you're worried about is having a means to break the conflict and get away. And I think that's important when we think about defensive tools for civilians versus compliance tools for law enforcement. And that's where a lot of gray stuff gets into the bullshit zone on YouTube and stuff with the same type of thing with, well, you know, if this martial art's so great, why aren't all the MMA guys doing it or whatever? Because MMA is a freaking sporting event with a referee and rounds. And the real world is a situation where the last thing I want is to show off my ability to lock an armbar on somebody on the ground if I'm being attacked by somebody in a real world situation, because I could get my head stomped to death. What I want to do is, by any means necessary, sever the connection between me and the threat while evaluating everything around me and getting myself and anybody else under my care and protection the hell out of Dodge. I mean, you got to think about, okay, This is the best analogy I have for this, and I'm surprised it took me this many years to come up with it, and it just came into my head. If I am hired as a bodyguard, and you are my client, and I am to protect you, and I have, let's say, another bodyguard with me, and I have me in front of you, and you're in front of me, and then my other guard is in front of you, so we have you kind of sandwiched in a situation, and there's a threat. Like somebody comes at you, they hate you. That's why you had a bodyguard in the first place. And they start threatening to harm you. Do you think that, like, me and the other bodyguard put you behind us and run over and beat the shit out of the threat? Do you think that's what we do? No. We immediately incapacitate, stall, delay the threat, shove your ass into a car, and get you away. I mean, that's security 101 when taking care of a client. You remove the client from the area of danger as quickly as possible because you realize that the attacker could be a decoy. Or even if they're not, because that sets up a target of opportunity for someone else that may want to harm your target, right, or their target. So you protect them. That's how we have to be our own bodyguards. Bodyguards do not stand and fight. They fight as much as necessary to protect the person they're protecting, and to get them the hell out of there. So in any of these situations, that's how you have to think. And carbon fiber may very well work. Like I said, I mean, if somebody grabs you and you're like, let me go, and they're like, I'm going to kick your ass or whatever, and you pulled one of those out and opened up their forearm with it, I mean, they've got a serious problem they have to deal with now, right? And so what? It's disposable. They're less than $20 anyway. You know? I mean, but see, this is the problem. Let's say that all happens at a giant stadium or something. Why did you have a knife? What are you going to lie and say, I didn't? I don't know. It was my fingernail? Like, I mean, that's going to get even more trouble. Why did you have a weapon with that capability? You weren't supposed to even have it there. Was it necessary? Right? The fact that you got away, you think would be like, well, see, it worked. But, you know, was the guy really going to hurt you? So you have to think really carefully, not just in this situation, but in any situation where you deploy any weapon that can be deemed as lethal defense, even if it's not used as a lethal defense mechanism, even because you cut somebody's arm like that, you hit the right spot, the right artery or whatever, they can bleed out. So you really have to think about deploying any weapon like that, whether it's a good idea to even, you know, consider it. And you only deploy lethal force where life is truly in danger. Let's take another one. Here's another one from Marty. Marty says, should I be using DEET bug repellent? More importantly, should I be using DEET on my children, 9 and 12? Details. I've been spraying my kids with DEET Woods Off almost every day of the summer camp season. They go to a day camp, not a sleepover. My main worry is deer ticks here in Maryland, and of course mosquitoes due to West Nile and now Zika, which is becoming prevalent. I also have a 100% DEET, Benz, and jungle juice in a pump, but I'm not comfortable using that on their bare skin. I'll only use it on boots and long pants when hiking in areas where I know ticks will be. I just don't trust Avon Skin So Soft and all natural repellents when natural effects of Lyme disease are so detrimental. I'm not giving the natural repellents. Am I not giving the natural repellents enough credit? Or in this case, where should I really be using the good stuff? Any advice would be appreciated. If you want to swing this one to Doc Bones for expert counsel question, that's fine too. Thanks for all you do, Marty. Okay, I'll say first of all, I think that the DEET is the best repellent that mankind has ever made to prevent bugs from biting, stinging, and attacking us. Whatever it is, right? There is nothing better. Number two, I personally believe that while it would probably be a bad idea to fill a bathtub with 100% DEET solution and sleep in it, that using DEET on your skin is safe. As safe as most other things that we don't even think about. I'm not going to say that there's no potential adverse reactions or something like that, because that's just stupid. It really is, because you don't really know. But we have not seen anything that indicates that anybody that uses DEET has ever gone into having seizures or gotten cancer or had neurological disease. And it's not even really a question. Now, there's a lot of, like, the alternative health types and all that do themselves no service by attacking everything just because it must be bad. There's no studies, and I've looked, that say, you know, conclusively or even, you know, potentially that there's a large risk to using this stuff. And it's been used so long by so many people, I don't really worry about it. Now, personally, I think the 100% concentrated stuff is pretty strong. And I prefer a product like Deep Woods Off or Cutter or something like that with, you know, like a 10% or something like that, and a spray. And I think you need to be very careful when applying it to make sure you don't get it into eyes because it can be extremely irritating to your eyes. People say, well, that proves it's not safe. Well, try some jalapeno juice in your eyes, dummy. But I also do like the 100% products. I think we had a product called Benz that I used to use, like not Benz, like B-E-N-D-S, B-E-N-S, right? Benz something that was 100% deep, came in a little bottle. And when I used to go turkey hunting in the spring, the mosquitoes were crazy. And I would put some of that on the brim of my hat and on the, I would wear it when I did turkey hunting in the spring, you're calling and you're full camo. And I would wear like a mesh, because it's still pretty warm out, mesh gloves and like a head net. And I would put some of that on the head net and the gloves, and it would really, really keep the mosquitoes down. And again, I think it's a very reasonable thing to use it. Like, let's say if you're wearing long pants down at the pant legs, socks, shoes, those are places ticks tend to egress onto the body. I do think it can also be effective used around the waistline, just little drops here and there on your pants in repelling chiggers. If I was really going to get tore up bad and I had a choice between really being tore up bad and using 100% and actually putting it on my skin, I would do that before I would get tore up bad. If you compare the potential, maybe because some guy that rubs flowers together and contemplates his navel says it's bad risk of DEET to Lyme disease, I'll take the potentially risky thing with the navel guy before the Lyme disease, please. I would say don't get overly concerned about Zika. The TV is ramping this up to a level of stupidity that I just don't think is necessary to worry about. And I wouldn't really worry. West Nile, I didn't worry about it when it was, oh my God, it's here. West Nile found in Dallas. And I had people emailing me, Jack, they said it's in Dallas. Aren't you afraid? No, no, no. Now, Zika, I think, could potentially be a major problem. It really could, because of the birth defect issue. And we have a question for Doc Bones about the long-term implications of Zika for women. Like, if you get Zika and you're like 12, and then you don't even know you got Zika when you were 12, and then like later you're like 24 and you didn't get Zika again, and you have a baby, is there any risk? I think the answer is no, but we'll let Doc answer that. But I'm not afraid to use this stuff. I am not a fan of using the 100% concentrated like as a rub down, though. I think if nothing else, it really smells bad, and I think if there's any potential for skin irritation, that's going to go up. But overall health and safety, you are putting less risk at yourself in using bug repellent than you are at being bitten by 500 mosquitoes, not to mention how miserable it makes people. It's just, to me, there's a lot of things to be concerned about. This isn't probably one of them. And I have a Popular Mechanics article about various studies and evaluation on the safety of DEET insect repellent in the show notes for you as well. So I mentioned in my show about knives that Patrick Rohrman was the guy that kind of got me on the school of thought with a neck knife of not using two hands when either drawing or returning a neck knife to its sheath. And almost every single time I do a workshop here or I go teach somewhere or something, if somebody asks about my neck knife, and I usually do carry it under my shirt, so I'll pull it out and I'll draw the knife. And when I remove the knife from the sheath, nobody really says anything. I'll hand it to them, I'll let them look at it. When they hand it back to me, I'll just kind of wiggle it. And you can watch the video and see how Patrick, you know, does it. Wiggle the tip in, turn it up, and I push it against my chest and it goes in. And it's always, you're going to stab yourself. It's like, no, it doesn't work that way. So I mentioned during that show about neck knives that Patrick should do a quick video. I think he did a video of about 3 minutes long, kind of going over the, you know, kind of quick one-handed draw use of the neck knife. And one thing he didn't cover, and I really kind of wish he did, is how much safer it actually is. Because we had it right here. Somebody bought a neck knife from Patrick. It comes with a little piece of paper that says not to do this. If you're going to not have it around your neck and you're going to draw the knife, you hold the string and you pull the knife out of the sheath. But people grab the sheath and pull the knife out of the sheath. And when he grabbed the knife, he put his thumb in the wrong spot, and when he drew the knife cut I think pretty much through the, like, think about the pad of your thumb through the fingernail. Probably could have used a couple stitches. Fortunately, between Dorothy being here and us having a really good first aid kit, put some Steri-Strips on it, and then the next day, my B mentor Jason showed up, and he's a paramedic, and he kind of reapplied everything, and, you know, the guy got through it, and, you know, it was okay, but it was a pretty serious cut that never had to happen. Well, do you think it's safer with two hands? But it's not. So watch the video and learn how to be safe with your neck knife. There's a link in today's show notes to a quick YouTube video by Patrick Rohrman of MT Knives. Here's an interesting one that was originally sent in for Mike and Sue Laprise of the Expert Council on Homeschooling, but I feel like they've answered so many versions of this question, and because of the way it was framed, I'm going to answer it. If Mike and Sue, if you're listening, if you want to take this one and add another one to your lineup for this month, you guys can go ahead and do this too. I'd love to hear or follow up online. That would be fine, but I'm going to take a shot at it first. It says, from Dylan, how do I maximize the edge interaction between government schools and self-directed learning? Details, my wife and I will be starting a family this year and determined that homeschooling is not an option for us. Was wondering how to get the best out of government schools while instilling self-directed learning attitude at home. This question is for your homeschooling experts, Mike and Sue Laprise. Cheers. Okay, so let's start out with something I wanted to kind of just put in your mind, Dylan, to think about. You're going to start a family this year. That means you're six years away. If everything goes to plan and mom and dad get together and baby comes very, very quickly, which doesn't always happen, you're at least 6 years away because you got 9 months and then you 5 years old to go into kindergarten. 6 years before you have to put that first child into a school, specifically a government school. So I'm just going to suggest before I answer your question that with 6 years of planning ahead of you, with massive changes coming to the education system and support for homeschooling, that if through those 6 years you do everything you can to try to figure out if you can avoid government schools, you may not be in the situation 6 years from now that you're in right now where you feel you'd have no choice. So stay open to it is all I'm saying. And my kid went to government school. I wouldn't judge you harshly for sending your own. I'm just suggesting you consider it that way. Now, as far as how to maximize the edge effect, the first thing we have to do, if we're going to be honest, those of us who are opposed to the current educational paradigm and current government school model, is acknowledge the things they do well. Because not everything they do sucks. A child who goes to school through, let's say, fifth grade even, in the government school systems, who gets reasonable support from his parents, that doesn't go to the worst school in the district, whatever one that one might be, or the worst district in the state, maybe, will at that point most likely be able to read and write at a reasonable level that they could actually function in society even in fifth grade. Now, maybe they don't have the emotional maturity for it, but a fifth grader's reading comprehension generally would allow the average person to function in life and not need somebody to tell them what everything meant. Okay, school does that. They will probably, if Common Core to the side, at least be able to do basic arithmetic, right? Add, subtract, multiply, and divide. They'll probably, I don't know, I've heard they're not even doing this anymore, but they'll probably know their times tables, their plus and minus and division up, you know, 1 to 12 or 0 to 12. Kind of zero is kind of redundantly stupid, but fine. If you want to make yourself feel better for having 13 levels, that's fine. It's kind of the kindergarten of math, I guess. So they'll have that. They'll probably know something about history. They'll probably know something about science. So they do get kind of the fundamentals of being able to learn even by fifth and sixth grade. And as they move into high school, junior high school, those years, they start to get the ability to take some electives. I think a foreign language is a fine thing for any child to take. And I think it's really sad that some blowback over the animosity over illegal immigration has kind of put, like, why should my kid learn Spanish? Because it's a second language, stupid. And because there's more people in this country that speak Spanish than any language other than English, than any other language. Stupid. That's why your child should learn Spanish. Because there's opportunities for the person that's fluent in both English and Spanish. Those are all good reasons to become very good at Spanish, but the reason we study foreign languages is then we understand our own better. You know, you learn verb conjugation in like fifth grade, fourth grade, et cetera. And then, you know, in high school, you learn Spanish and you learn to conjugate Spanish verbs. And then you go, oh, shit, now I get it. Now I understand it better. You start understanding the roots of words and where they come from in the history of language. So that's an option that's available. So I would say as your children get into kind of the junior high levels, is really spend time with them on figuring out what electives they're going to take. I mean, I know that when I decided what electives I want to take, it's just like they handed you a list and I pick shit. And they said, like, well, you need a certain number of math credits. And now that you've got, you know, your first two, you have all these different ones you can pick math from. No one sat down with me and said, hey, what are you interested in? You know, the non-guidance counselor wasn't there, right? Parents didn't think that was really important. Like, hey, let them pick whatever he wants. But no one had a conversation with me. I think it would be good to have conversations with your children about what electives they want to take as they get older. And then I think you should take what the school does well and make sure you're giving enough reinforcement on it so that your kids get that out of it, but then translate that into what you don't have to do. If your kid knows how to read, then we can use reading to learn other things. And I think one of the big things you can do is create self-directed learning projects for them based around their interests and incentivize them to do that. So what I mean by that is all kids want shit. They constantly want shit. And much of the shit that they want, you're going to give them. Right? You might actually make them wait longer for it because they keep asking for it. So with that in mind, you might be able to not really give them something they weren't going to get anyway, but they don't know that. They're kids, right? So if your child has, they have desire A. Well, just instead of making it specific, there's a certain thing they want, we'll call it desire A. And they want you to help that become fulfilled. Well, then you point out that you have a desire too. And that is for them to learn something new this week, this month, whatever, however long you want to make the project. And that if they give you what you want, you'll give them what they want. Now, this is actually far more productive to me than if you follow the rules for a week, Susie. All but because you're supposed to follow the rules anyway. And a violation of the rules should have a consequence independent of getting what you want with this other desire A, right? We're making a trade. Value for value. You want A, I want you to do B. And they say, well, I don't like B. Well, how do you know you don't like B? Because I don't want to have enough school or whatever. No, desire B does not entail me telling you what to learn. I'm going to set parameters for what you're going to learn, like what you have to know about it. You tell me what you want to learn about. What do you want to learn? What are you interested in? Right? I can't think of anything. Well, when you want desire A, come back to me with some ideas and we'll work it out. Don't push. Walk away. Plant the seed. I'm telling you, kid's going to come back. Well, what if I learned about this? And as long as it's reasonable, sure. Now, I'm going to develop a program for you to follow, right? An outline. These are all the things I want you to learn about. So I want you to bring me and show me. I want you to do it orally. I want you to give me a written report, whatever it is. And I think orally would be the best way to prove that somebody knows something. When somebody knows something, they need very little notes, information, paperwork to prove it. The reason that I can do this show is because I talk about subjects that I know about. I don't write a script. When I first started doing the show, people really thought, like, there has to be a script. You have to sit down. No. In fact, I have something cool for those of you coming to the fall event that I just found. I used to do, in the very beginning, I did my show mostly with a 5x7 note card in the console. I kept them in the console of my Jetta. I did the show, for those that are new, for 18 months in my car before I started doing it in a studio environment. And that's all I had. Well, along the way, the cards, like, started, you get cards everywhere and stuff. And I just saw one of the basic notebooks, you know, like the black and white ones, like the kids use in school with the spine that's like a black spine. You guys, like a theme book, they call them. And I started using that. And I would just I'd open a page and I'd write a couple notes. And then the next day, I'd just turn the page and write some more notes. And I would just have that book, you know, I would use like a clip, like a big chick clip to keep the book from folding shut. And I just set that in the seat, and every once in a while I'd just pick it up, kind of look at, oh yeah, that's right, that's where I was, and I'd just keep rolling with it. I found one of those books. I don't know what time frame it was, but it's somewhere in that 18 months of my notes from the early show. So I'm going to let people look at that at the workshop. But when you can actually teach that way, then you actually know your material. And here's the other thing. When you teach, you learn at a higher level, right? So if a person is shown, demonstrate, told something, and their percentage or their factor of memory for it would be a one. They're one time, whatever, one time space credit, whatever. If you then say now you replicate this, it goes from a one to a ten. A person that then sees it, observes it, takes it in, and then does it themselves is 10 times more likely than the person who just seen and told. Now, if you take the person once they've done it, and then you say, now teach it to this person, and they become the teacher, they go up another 10-fold or 100-fold over the original. And that's factual. So I would say that the biggest thing I want out of my kids is I want you to develop enough information to come back and tell me about this, and I'll judge whether you've learned enough. And if you haven't, I'm not going to say you passed or failed. What I'm going to say is, I think you need to get me some more information on this, this, and this. And you write down a little list, just a tiny little list. Now go do that. And come back and have a and then you go research it yourself. And then have a conversation with them about it. Well, yeah, I know that too. I read that too. How do you feel about that? This is what I think. And bring them up to an adult level of conversation. This is a skill set that one person, the kid's trying to get a job if one's available. And they're going in there to interview with somebody, and they have to have a conversation with the interviewer. They're better prepared for that job than what any course is going to teach them, because they know how to have that level of conversation. They know how to have an opinion about something. So I think those are like ways that you can actually begin to work that interactive edge. You develop in your child a passion for knowledge and have enough of a check on your own ego to not tell them what that knowledge should be about. Well, all my kid wants to learn about is video games. Well, unless it's all the cheat codes, right, or whatever, if they actually want to learn about how to program them, a lot of people make a lot of money doing that. You know? I'm just saying. And if it is just playing video games, then you have to say, look, playing video games is, you don't tell your kids it's a bad thing, because that just makes them want to do it more. That's a fine thing. But there's a lot of things dad and mom like to do. We can't do them all the time. We have to vary what we do. And there's this block of time for video games. So since you're not trying to learn how to become a programmer, and no, playing it for the 100th time will not make you a better programmer. Don't tell dad that. Dad's smarter than I use that lie with my Atari son, okay? Right? Atari, what's Atari? Don't you worry about it, young whippersnapper. I use that lie with my Atari, and I never knew to program nothing, and that is not pro. So anyway, you set that aside and say, that's fine. Here's your time allotment for that. This is your recreation time. This is learning time. So if you want to learn how video games are programmed, if you want to learn how they're manufactured, if you want to learn something like that, fine. Or if you want to go out and learn about frogs or dogs or stars or whatever. And this is where you really have to work with your kids. School will tell them they don't have a choice. You're telling them that they do. School is programming that they're supposed to be told what to do. Your counter-programming is you're not always going to be told what to do. But learning's important. And if you do that, I think you'll do very well. But again, finishing up here, don't write yourself off at being able to homeschool, because you're talking about something that's 6, 7, 8 years away right now. And you don't know what, especially if you want to, over those next years, you could set up to enable yourself at a higher level, or even saying 9, 10 years, because I honestly believe when it comes to school, kindergarten, first grade, second grade, third grade, fourth grade, like that right there, that is the most benevolent years of government schooling. It really is, and I don't see much harm coming from it, other than if a child's bullied. But otherwise, it's pretty benevolent. It's as the mind expands, the attempt to control the mind rather than encourage its growth that really bothers me. And by high school, the programming of you have to go to college is evil enough in itself that I think that system needs to go away. And I think it's just a flawed system overall. But definitely also, I mean, remember that learning is innate. So trips to the zoo, trips to museums, things like that, things that like the field trips we used to go on, they don't do that shit anymore. They do it once a year, maybe. Take your kids places like that and learn about it. Here's how you say, I don't know what I want to learn about. Why don't you do a report on animals? I don't want to. Why not? I don't like animals. Okay, you know what? Instead of that, we're going to go to the zoo. Do I get desire A? No. But we're just going to go to the zoo. You don't want to go to the zoo? I want to go to the zoo. Take them to the zoo. They're going to go apeshit over something. Leopards or snakes or geckos. I don't know. They're going to go apeshit over something. So then when you come home, you go, man, that leopard was cool, wasn't it? Yeah. Where do leopards come from? Well, they come from here. I saw that and I think, how many leopards are left in the world? I don't know. You know, remember that thing you wanted, Desire A? Oh, yeah, like they forgot all of that because they kind of did, right? You know, maybe you could do that report on leopards or something else you saw today. Why don't you let me know if that's what you want to do tomorrow? It's all psychology, folks. It's encouraging the innate natural behaviors instead of suppressing them. On education, last little story here. More changes coming to education, open source textbooks. There are several different groups now producing open source textbooks. I noticed in my local community college newsletter that are moving over to them. You can still buy a printed on-demand copy at the school bookstore, but most college students now prefer the electronic copy. Since the school determines what textbooks you use, they can put traditional publishers out of business as soon as other options become available. With all the complaints about how much college costs, I'm wondering if there's a way for schools to cut the costs without affecting their revenue much. I know some professors write textbooks and get paid well for it, which always seemed like a conflict of interest to me. Jerry, I call it the great textbook scam. You're a professor of some bullshit at some bullshit university, and you've never held a job in your life, so you write a textbook that you get paid royalties on, and if you can get four or five or six colleges across the country to mandate that, you have a guaranteed number of sales every freaking year. Hallelujah, capitalism. That is not how capitalism is supposed to work, by the way. And you're probably a socialist writing a book about socialism using that bastardized capitalistic system to enrich yourself at the expense of the minds you're supposed to be educating while bashing capitalism. Hoorah for you. Just saying. It's actually preposterous. It's actually preposterous that in 2016 there is a such thing as a textbook in printed form unless the student wishes for it in that form. The fact that anywhere that that's mandated at this point is ridiculous. Now, that doesn't mean that creators of these textbooks can't be compensated for their time and for the effort. It's a tremendous amount of work. And for all I just said, beating them up there. I mean, think about it. Think about a textbook and then think about writing it. Just really think about it. It's you know, how many books have you written, right? But I think that if you look at what is probably the singest sole depository of knowledge in the world today that's easily accessible? And hint, it's not Google, because Google's not that. Google's a search engine. Google finds the information all over the place. But what's one place you can go and find out quite a bit about almost anything? So much so that you haven't seen an encyclopedia salesman at your front door for a very long time. That would be Wikipedia. You know, I was watching a rerun of Friends, and that show dates itself mostly only on technology. And it was an episode where Penn Jillette was a Penn and Teller was a guest star, and he comes to the door of Chandler and Joey's house. And Joey's the only one home, and he's selling encyclopedias. And Joey only has enough money to buy the V encyclopedia, so he starts learning everything he can out of the V encyclopedia to sound smarter. But he can only talk about subjects that start with V, right? And if you think about it, when I was in high school and you had to do a report on something, the first thing you did was go down to the library. You went home if you had a set, pull out, you know, World Book Encyclopedia, Encyclopedia Britannica, and you looked up, if you had to do a report on Germany, Germany, started reading. Yeah, we had a set of world books at home that were from 1968. I didn't do very well on my reports that I used those encyclopedias for, but that's what I had. So Wikipedia. Now, you could say, well, Wikipedia is run by a bunch of liberal jerks that control the system and, you know, they censor content and all. And to some degree, that's true. And in some other parts of it, not so much. It is group collective think. And despite the fact that it has some flaws, it is, in my opinion, the single largest collection of mostly accurate information that's ever existed on planet Earth that is accessible to so many people. If we look at the great collections like the Alexandria Library, right, in Egypt, right? That, I mean, it was an incredible collection of knowledge, but how accessible was it? Anybody with a computer or a tablet or a cell phone can access Wikipedia today and get genuinely relevant information about almost any subject. Now, how was that? Think about this. If I said to you, you know what I want you to do? I want you to write Wikipedia. Now, let's say that Wikipedia didn't exist yet, and I don't know how I would even explain how in-depth I wanted the information to be, but I came to you as an author, or even a group of 10 authors, and said, I want you to author this giant electronic encyclopedia, and I want it to be available to everybody, and I want you to write that. I think if I came to you 10 years ago, the 10 of you would still be working. And probably, no, you probably would have quit by now and hated me and maybe shot me or something. But yet, Wikipedia continues to grow and expand and develop. And despite some of the Nazi-like tendencies of some of the liberal idiots that do seem to have a pretty good stranglehold on parts of Wikipedia, overall, they do a pretty decent job of like keeping spam out of it and keeping non-factual information out of it and preventing things like congressmen from removing things they don't like from their own entry and, you know, restoring that information. And then the beauty of Wikipedia is if somebody does like just delete a page, because you can literally go on to Wikipedia and delete a page, there's a record kept of every single thing that ever was done to that page, and you can revert back to it. So it can't really be vandalized. And then the offender can then be blocked and banned and banished, etc. And if you think of TSP Wiki, that's all that is using Wiki software to create a survival and self-sufficiency Wiki. And if you go to tspwiki.com, where Alex puts the history segments every day, you'll find it's a lot more than history segments. There's articles on almost everything in self-sufficiency and self-reliance and survivalism at tspwiki.com. Why? Because so many people from this audience have gone on there and done one thing. Well, why can't we build textbooks that way? And that's how you end up doing it. And that's how you get authors that will write a part of a textbook without expecting to be compensated for the rest of their life from it, because they only wrote a little piece. And why not, if you were doing the V Encyclopedia, right, have the world's foremost expert on Mount Vesuvius write that portion, but you have the world's foremost expert on volcanoes write the section for volcanoes, right? And if you could even break that down into sub-niches. Imagine if you had a textbook where the best mind on the individual niche wrote the page or two on it. Well, it would be the greatest textbook with the most knowledge ever transferred. So my question, though, is really, do we even need open source textbooks? Can we not get to a point where there's so much information immediately sourceable and indexable available that the answer to anything can be found? And what we actually need is open source lesson plans, enabling people how to learn. All of this just tells me once again, the current educational paradigm is about to be torn apart. It's about to be ripped apart to shreds. I'm telling you, in 10 years, you won't recognize it. In 20 years, I don't think you'll see anything approaching what you would call today the education system. It will be so radically, dramatically different. And I think 40 years from now, when people learn about how we educated students for over 150 years, they're going to say, what the hell is wrong with those people? They had the internet since the mid-90s. What took them so long? Why were they so foolish? Why were they so slow to adapt to change? Or who knows? Maybe they'll be dealing with some problems of their own, like, oh, I don't know, they won't figure out how to fix it, and that $150 trillion worth of unfunded liabilities might be a problem at that point. But we shall see. With that, if you like this show and the work that I do, please consider joining the Member Support Brigade. If you do that, you can support this show at about 18.3 cents an episode, but hell, call it 20 cents. If you think today was worth 20 cents, consider joining. Just go to thesurvivalpodcast.com and click on Members to learn more there. And if you're military, law enforcement, Peace Corps, or first responder, like an EMT, paramedic, or firefighter, active duty, or prior service, you do qualify for a discount. Email me, jack@thesurvivalpodcast.com, with TSPC service discount in the subject line. Tell me about your service in one or two sentences, and I'll get you that discount code back. Please do that before, not after you join. It's really kind of a sticky wicket after you join, to use something my British friend Neil Franklin used to say all the time. And remember, please, that the MSB is how this show gets supported. It's the number one way And remember that it is profitable to you to be a member if you're buying anything from seeds to bullets to guns to reloading equipment to long-term storage equipment. We have so many discounts for you. Your membership will pay for itself many times over, every year. And you can try for $5 if you want to. You can sign up today, a 1 month renewable membership at $5. If you don't like it, go into PayPal and cancel it. That's the most risk-free way there is, or go ahead and sign up for a year. Most people seem to like it. I was going through some of the membership records, and I have members that have been members since the first day that are still members, and I still hear from on occasion saying how much value they get out of it and how much value they get out of the show. Guys, thank you for that. When I hear from long-term listeners that are still with me after 7, 8 years, man, it makes what I'm doing really feel like it's worth it. So thank you so much for that. Next up, the other way to support this show is to go to the go to tspaz.com whenever you want to shop on Amazon. T-S-P-A-Z for the Survival Podcast Amazon. If you go to tspaz.com, you'll have a link there, and you click that link, and you just go shop on Amazon for any and all items. Or you can see the current item of the day if you want to. And today's item of the day is, well, it's pretty awesome. And there was kind of a foreshadowing that it might be here. I was asked recently in a show about like electric knife sharpeners for the kitchen. And basically I said, they're all crap. And I still think, you know, with this one exception aside, it's really not a kitchen knife sharpener, it's a knife sharpener, they are all crap. And I had some people say, like, you know, I tried this one and it works and my knives cut tomatoes now, whatever. And you look at the reviews and you look at the pictures and you look at what the blade looks like after these things get done with it, and it's horrible. There's pieces of metal torn out. It's awful what these spinning wheel sharpeners do. Well, somebody wrote in, and I covered this when they wrote in last week and said, hey, I bought this thing, or actually called in to the call-in show last week and said, I bought this thing called a Work Sharp. It was about $70. I went through all my knives in my kitchen. I'm pretty happy with it. And I was like, yeah. And so I looked it up, and as soon as I saw it, I said, well, maybe. Because it uses it's basically a small belt sharpener. And professional bladesmiths use basically big belt sharpeners. So I bought one. I bought the Ken Onion edition. Ken Onion, it sounds kind of funny. Ken Onion is a world-renowned, award-winning custom knife maker. And I guess he collaborated on this particular version of it. And it works really good. It works really good. I started out with like a cheap Mora that was kind of really had no edge left to it. And played with it and was able within, you know, 10 minutes, not even reading the instructions, just kind of intuitively figuring it out. And I don't advise that, by the way. You know, get it shaving sharp. And then I touched up a couple kitchen knives with some of the finer grain belts on it. And then I'm like, okay, let me see what this will really do. So I have this, it's like a cheap Santoku. It's, I can't think of who makes it. It's like, you know, Chef something or something like you would buy at the gadget section at Albertson's supermarket. Like, not the cheapest one, but it's pretty cheap. And I'm really hard on my wife about knives because she's so abusive to them. And so unless she's cutting something, she really needs something sharp. I've been making her use this thing, and she's been abusing it for like 2 years without it being sharpened. So I pull it down off the magnetic strip, and I take my finger and I touch the blade and I laugh. And I swear to God, I push my thumb on it and I move my thumb across it with pressure and it won't cut my thumb. It is dull. I'm dragging it across my hand. There's no edge left. I'm looking at it, I can't see an edge on it. So I'm like, okay, this isn't just dull, the edge is gone. There's no remnant of an edge. It's basically a butter knife, right? So this thing comes with these different belts, and the one belt, they say, is not really for sharpening. It's either for fixing knives or sharpening tools like chisels and stuff like that. So I pop that one on, set it to 18 degrees, good angle for a kitchen knife, and I start going over it. I've got to actually grind enough metal at this point now to get that edge on there. So I kind of get it to where I can see that that's really taking place. It's got a lot of places where there's some little missing, you can look real close and see pieces of metal missing from the abuse that it's gone through. And I take it till that's gone. And then I put the coarsest sharpening belt on. I do that until it's sharp. And it, you know, but it needs some more honing. I go down another level and I go down to the honing belt. And I get this thing and I take it across my arm and it peels hair off like a razor blade. It's a good sharpener. It's about $120, $130 for the Ken Onion Deluxe Edition, $69 for the basic model. The Ken Onion Edition, I like the way the belt comes off of it better. It has more angles that are available. You just basically turn a dial to decide your angle. It goes from 15 to, I think, 25 degrees. which is, you know, for everything you'd ever want to do there. And it's just a really, really great tool. So far, actually 15 to 30 degrees. So you can go to a 30 degree edge if you want to with it. It is intuitive. I will say Patrick said that some of his concerns with it are not really concerns, like the cons. He said there's a lot of pros with it. There really is. Some of the cons are, since the belts are short belts, it's a small belt, that they can heat up faster and you can overheat and damage a knife. I would agree, but as a variable speed control, and if you learn to use it right, that's not going to happen. He said the belts are kind of expensive because they're proprietary, where larger machines use kind of an industry standard belt. Yeah, but the whole set of belts $10. You can sharpen a lot of knives with a set of belts before you have to replace them. So I think if you're Patrick and you're making hundreds of knives and sharpening thousands of knives, yeah, but I think for us, not so much. I've heard a lot of people now getting back to me that I own one. They like it. It's got great reviews. It's like 4.5 stars out of 1,127 reviews on Amazon. And if you read some of the like 1- and 2-star reviews, you just go, these are people that you can't base your decision on their opinion, because their opinion is dumb. They don't know how to sharpen a knife, and therefore they can't use the tool. Now, as I said, any tool requires knowledge to use appropriately. What I recommend, you get some cheap-ass knives. Like, you probably have some dull-ass knives you've given up on that are cheap. They're like, if they were new, they were $10, and they're in a drawer somewhere. Start with those. Go to, what am I trying to think of now? Goodwill. Go to like Goodwill and see if they have some cheap, you know, straight edge knives laying around there. Get some of those for a couple bucks a piece or something like that if you don't have any, and learn to use the tool. Watch the DVD, go through it, learn to get that smooth motion. You know, it has an edge angle guide, but that you have to keep the blade flat against that edge, and you don't push hard because then you actually move the guide, right? So you kind of learn a feel and a touch for it and give it a shot. And I think that most of you that, you know, live in a world without sharp knives, that this would change that for you. I really do. And I think it's a great tool. And I don't remember who it was that recommended it, who bought it. But thank you. I finally found something that is consumer level, that does a professional job. That I think anybody that gave themselves an hour of playing with it, with some knives they weren't worried about hurting, you might burn up a belt or two if you do it really wrong. But once that was done, you'd be able to sharpen knives. Now, it doesn't mean you're going to sharpen the Patrick Roarman sharp, but sharp enough for everyday use, definitely. And the more you use it, the better you'll get with it. So that's the item of the day today. And remember, tspaz.com for all your Amazon shopping does really help us, whether you buy a knife sharpener or dog diapers, doesn't matter. And I know it's August, but this is one, you know, being a price point over $100 and stuff, you might be looking toward Christmas with this type of thing and all. This is a good tool. I would have been happy to get this for Christmas for sure. And that leads us to today's closing song. I decided to reach way back in time to 1978 and bring you a song from when songwriters actually wrote music. And sometimes they were even included in movies, and the movies didn't suck and the songs didn't suck and the ideas were original. This one's from Eddie Rabbit, and it's called Every Which Way But Loose. And for a lot of you folks out there that are, you know, a bit younger than me, folks that are like, let's say 30 or something, this is an old movie you may have never seen. This is when Clint Eastwood was young. That's how old this movie is. It's also from 78, is the soundtrack that the song came out on. But enjoy this song, and if you've never seen Every Which Way But Loose, give it a shot. And this was a movie that had a follow-up called Any Which Way You Can, and both of them are pretty good movies. They revolve around bare-knuckle boxing, and one thing I can say for MMA is they've ruined all these old movies, because fights never looked like this. And certainly now the average person knows fights never look like they do in the movies. But there was still something fun about it. There's something positive about some forms of nostalgia, and I think these movies and this music from this time is one of them. And if you're looking for something different to kind of remove yourself from the Ass Clown Circus of 2016, you could do worse than watching an old Clint Eastwood movie, or at least enjoying an old song from one. With that, this has been Jack Spierko with another edition of the Survival Podcast, helping you figure out how to live that better life if times get tough, or even if they don't.
I've always been the kind of man who doesn't believe in strings. Long-term obligations are just unnecessary things. But girl, you got me thinking,
while I'm drinking one more beer. If I'm headed for a heartache, then why the hell am I still here? I'm testing my resistance, and it's wearing mighty thin. I've got the feeling I should leave before the roof caves in. My mind tells me to move along, but my body begs me to stay. And now I feel the need to hold you close and love the night away while you're turning me every which way but loose. You turn me every which way but loose. Inside the fire's burning me, in my mind you just keep turning me every which way but loose. Baby, there's no excuse to turn me every which way but loose. When the sun comes up in the morning, it should find me someplace new. But right this minute, all I want is to lay here next to you. Those memories still keep calling me from somewhere in my past. Better hurry if they want me, 'cause I can feel me fading fast while you're turning me every which way but loose. You turn me every which way but loose. Inside the fire's burning me, in my mind you just keep turning me every which way but loose. Baby, there's no excuse to turn.